Monster Man. Special episode, Minotaur.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Chris. And Chris has asked me to go way back to Season 1, and also to the world of Greek mythology, and talk about the Minotaur, or Minotaurs. I note that different people pronounce this in different ways. I have always said Minotaur. I have looked it up, and either Minotaur or Minotaur is acceptable, but I've always said Minotaur, so that's what I'm going to say. Chris writes, "The great thing about going through the old monster books is that they hit that nostalgia button. Even without the books in front of me, I can still picture the art in my head, having looked at them so much growing up. Like a lot of people of a certain age, my first foray into D&D was the Caves of Chaos. It was there that I got my first taste of RPGs, and my first taste of death in RPGs. The Minotaur killed my dwarf. In the years since, I've wanted to go back to the caves and avenge them. My dwarf character's name escapes me, but the Minotaur as a formidable monster has stuck. Have you done a deep dive in the Minotaur before? Obviously, there's the myth of the Minotaur in Theseus, but the creature itself has become its own race in RPGs. I genuinely thought I had done a Minotaur special episode, but I went back and looked for it, and apparently I haven't. So, let's do one. So, Chris, thank you very much for your support. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Chris and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to the $5 reward of getting your own special episode, you'll also get episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which we talk about religion and mythology in fantasy role-playing games. And indeed, might cross over a little bit with this one. Okay. So Chris talks about the fact that the unique creature, the Minotaur of Greek mythology, has been turned into a species, Minotaurs. And this is a pretty common way that unique monsters from mythology are treated in Dungeons & Dragons. So another example would be like Medusas. Now obviously there are multiple Gorgons in Greek mythology, but it's weird that there are Medusas, if you see what I mean. Or even like Chimeras or Pegasi, right? Those are all unique creatures in the mythology they come from. But one thing that kind of stands out about the Minotaur is that this change was not made by D&D, and I think that by the time D&D came out, this idea already kind of existed in the popular consciousness. The earliest example that I can find of there being Minotaurs, lots of them, is in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which comes out in 1950. So if someone knows of an earlier reference, I'd be happy to hear about it. If we're assuming that the idea of there being lots of Minotaurs comes from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, this sort of makes sense, right? Because I think Lewis is trying to combine the idea of an evil horde, you know, of having a big enemy army so that the heroes can be the underdogs, but not having too many individual characters, well, on either side, so that, you know, it's not so hard to keep track of. And he also wanted to use monsters that his young readers would know about. And of course, the Minotaur, because of its familiarity from mythology, would be a good example of that. Like I say, there may be earlier examples. It strikes me that one of the reasons that this is appropriate for Lewis is that the Minotaurs are being like part of an army in a big battle, I think is where they turn up in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And that would appeal to the creators of D&D because, of course, they were war gamers. And a lot of the time, I think they looked at, you know, fantastic creatures in terms of how they would appear as units on a war games table. Hence, I think the fixation with giants throwing boulders in Dungeons & Dragons. Like, every giant has some kind of, well, maybe not every, but of the over a dozen different types of giant, almost all of them have some kind of description of the projectiles they throw. And I rather think that that's because giants sort of played almost like a cannon-like role in chainmail or whatever. So it's nice to be able to have a regiment of Minotaurs rather than just a Minotaur, right? If you're thinking about a war game, you're thinking about units of figures. Last time I also mentioned that, of course, in the Greek myth, the Minotaur is a half-human, half-animal being, and its unnatural nature, its whole backstory of how it came to be created, is a punishment from the god Poseidon because the king of Crete, the eponymous Minos, did not sacrifice the white bull that Poseidon sent him, but instead kept it for himself. And as a result, Poseidon cursed the queen to fall in love with the bull, And there's a whole complex explanation of how that came to pass, but the end result is that the Minotaur was born, and so it was put into the labyrinth, and people were sent in to be eaten by it, because it ate people, until the Greek hero Theseus came and slew it, with the aid of Minos' daughter, Ariadne. I can't believe that I didn't say this in that episode, but one of the fundamental rites of ancient Greek worship was animal sacrifice. And animals were sacrificed to the gods. They were eaten by the community, but then parts of them were burned. And the idea was that the gods would absorb their essence through the smoke and vapors from the burning. And different animals were considered to be more or less desirable, and roughly in proportion to sort of how expensive they were. You know, how much of an economic hit you were taking by making this sacrifice. That is to say, how much of a sacrifice it was. Although, of course, what that meant was that the really big sacrifices were available only to the wealthy, which kind of was the whole idea. And the most desirable sacrificial animal was a bull, or better yet, 100 bulls. The sacrifice of 100 bulls, a hecatomb, was, you know, the big public sacrifice. And of course, for an individual to have the kind of wealth to offer a hecatomb to the gods, that's a pretty big deal. So the story of the Minotaur is an inversion, an ironic or horrific inversion of the normal relationship. Instead of the humans sacrificing the bull to the gods, they are being sacrificed to it. And to the modern eye, the story maintains its horror, I think, because even though we don't burn the fat-covered thigh bones of cattle as an offering to Olympian Zeus, we do kill a lot of cattle. And if the bull wants to kill us, it is hard to deny that it has a point. Humans as a whole have done wrong to bulls as a whole, or at least you wouldn't blame a bull if it saw matters in that light. And the idea that bulls are especially sacred or holy or appropriate to the gods or whatever is a widespread one, not just in ancient Greek religion, but in other ancient and contemporary religions, you know, perhaps because of their great physical power, perhaps because of their high economic value. Bulls have often signified divine power. So bull images occur in a wide range of different contexts. A good example would be at the settlement site of Çatalhöyük, one of the sort of earliest, it's not even really a town, kind of proto-towns from kind of toward the end of the Neolithic period. There are kind of bull images on walls there, bull heads. I think they're actually skulls with kind of clay rendering to make them look a bit more like living heads, although they're symbolic. It's been a long time since I read all this Çatalhöyük stuff. It's something that you do when you study archaeology. You know, no matter what period you study, you're going to wind up reading about Çatalhöyük at some point. You get divine bulls in Mesopotamia. If you listen to patron deities, we've talked about how Marduk is likened to a bull. Hadad, the sort of thunder god, is depicted with bull horns, also called Ishkur or Ramon, I think he's also sometimes called. And, you know, bulls don't just have to be about strength. So, for instance, if you look at kind of like the Hindu tradition, it's the idea of a bull as like a generative power and as like a giver of wealth and of health, of food. You know, the cows in general are supposed to be protected for that reason. You know, we know that it's Hindu custom, like, not to kill a cow or to harm it. But in fact, you know, the slaughter of cattle is actually illegal in many parts of India. But also, we've heard a lot of bull-themed praise of people in the Rig Veda. We've heard Indra being likened to a bull. Indra rides on a bull. And we've heard some other deities. I think we heard Soma or Indu being praised as a bull in the most recent episode. So this idea is pretty widespread, even in modern fiction, right? Like, take a look at the way that the kind of special bad guy in 13th Warrior has bull horns on his headgear. So in that sense, we can see how the bull is an image of divine power, which, of course, is something that you would get in a monster. But the Minotaur specifically is supposed to be kind of horrific and unnatural. And that's supposed to be the origin of its desire to eat people, right? It's an unnatural thing. And as an unnatural thing, it requires unnatural food. You can see this in Warhammer Fantasy Battle. I don't know if this is true today because I haven't really kept up that much. But in previous editions of Warhammer Fantasy Battle, if a unit of Minotaurs destroyed an enemy unit, they actually had to make a leadership test to see whether they could continue fighting, like go on and attack somebody else, or whether they would stop to eat the people they had just killed. So actually, you know, beating an enemy unit might not necessarily be the best thing for your Minotaurs to do, because it might wind up, in practice, taking them out of the fight. So this, you know, the idea is that because this monster is unnatural, it eats in an unnatural way, right? Again, it's an inversion. Normally, humans eat cow, not the other way around. But the problem with the idea of the Minotaur as like an unnatural violation of nature's laws is that the shine has kind of worn off the idea of it being unnatural. Probably in antiquity, that idea sort of faded away, right? Because, like, when I mentioned the idea that Lewis includes the Minotaur in Narnia, you know, Minotaur-Z rather than just Asterion the Minotaur, because of its familiarity. It has a certain distance from us and a certain aura of respectability that classical myth has in the modern day. Classical mythology, even compared to other mythologies that we've been thinking about for a long time, you know, Norse mythology or Sumerian mythology or whatever, but of all of them, classical mythology is the squarest. It's the one that some, you know, earnest romantic or even Renaissance artist, like, painted a painting of, and, like, it would be in a textbook. Whatever power it had to shock, it's hard to find for our audiences because we're so used to seeing, with Ray Harryhausen movies and books for kids and Hercules comics and so forth, there's been a little bit of a revival of interest in, like, the gnarlier side of classical mythology, but I think it's an uphill struggle compared to, say, Eastern European folklore is widely understood to be, like, the home of spookiness at present, not least because of things like The Witcher. You know, so paradoxically, the fact that knowledge of classical mythology is so widespread robs the Minotaur of some of its power to shock. It feels like part of the natural world, not part of the unnatural world. Now, that's not to say that you can't have an effective use of the sort of vanilla Minotaur. Obviously, if you're a young player encountering the idea of fantasy role-playing for the first time, running into a legendary beast in a way that's interactive, plus also, like, it kills you with an axe or whatever, that is pretty memorable. But for us jaded elderly types, how do we take this monster that's become a little bit predictable and rub some funk on it? The first approach is to try and reinvent it. You know, I actually had a Minotaur-inspired villain or NPC anyway, in a vampire game that I ran for years. I don't know how Minotaur he was. Originally, what happened was I had a group of people and I wanted them to seem weird and exotic, but also like ancient and kind of, you know, strangely menacing. So what I did then was what I often do in that case, which is give them all Etruscan names. Etruscan names have that thing where they sound enough like what makes sense to our ear as ancient names to have that kind of feel, but they're also not immediately recognizable. So it's a good compromise. I do this on a lot of games. I've had multiple games, including this one, where I had, a demon or a monster or spirit or something called Kalukasu, which means made holy of bronze, I believe, and is the Etruscan name for what we would call Talos. In this case, I chose the Etruscan name Devruminis, which just means Minotaur, right? It's literally, Devru is like a bull, Taurus, and Minis just is Minos. So it's just backward, right? It's like if it was called a Tauraminis. Having given him this name and discovered that it means, you know, Minotaur, I decided that there would be like a labyrinth component to him. So at one point he was in a sort of, you know, ancient slumber, what they call torpor in vampire. And the PCs like entered his sleeping mind through plot methods. And that I framed as kind of like being in this labyrinth that was constructed out of his memories. So, you know, the dungeon, as it were, was essentially constructed of the interiority of this character who had been kind of locked away for hundreds of years. So in that case, I was just using the Minotaur myth to provide kind of echoes and symbology in a different type of creature. That's one approach, and I think it can work, but also I think you can get the Minotaur back to basics, right? A lot of these monsters will work fine if you just focus on what it is about them that makes them frightening in the first place. And in the case of the Minotaur, I think this thing should not be space has already been effectively occupied by your Cthulhus and what have you. So actually, you want to focus on the physicality of it a bit more. Think about the brute strength of a bull, about the like placid unknowability of its expression, the deep sound of its breath, the odor, you know, the not that great odor, but a familiar odor in a way. Then add to that blood matting its little beard, the glimmer of some kind of tortured intelligence in its sullen eyes, you know, as it begins to attack. Describe like the bone-crunching impact of its fists. You know, comparatively few bullfighters are killed in bullfights, right? Fight is kind of a misnomer. It's not really very evenly matched. But when they do get hit, You know, to be gored by a bull's horns, that's pretty frightening. But also, just to have this massive beast slam into you going so fast, we can know, in scientific terms, this thing doesn't, you know, if you were hit by a car, that's going faster probably and it weighs more. But it's more horrifying that it's a living creature somehow. So think about that bone-crunching impact. Think about the gouts of blood where its monstrous bronze axe cleaves into someone. You know, have the PCs discover it hunched amid the remains of its last victim, snuffling and grunting as it crams raw human flesh into its blood-slobbered mouth with disquietingly human hands, and you're good to go, right? Having the PCs arrive just as the monster is finishing murdering someone else is a hack move, but the thing about hack moves is that they work. The third approach is to humanize the Minotaur, which is, after all, in some ways a tragic figure. As an unwanted child, inflicted as a punishment for something that he had nothing to do with, made a monster by a vengeful god in punishment for crimes not his own, in punishment for crimes by someone that he's not even related to. Minos is not his father. You know, he was locked in a prison, denied freedom, denied the outdoors. Like, it's easy to see how you could sympathize with the Minotaur. He's clearly been dealt a pretty poor hand. At the same time, still eats people. It's kind of a Frankenstein's monster kind of a situation, where the monster, like, murders a child and frames a lady for it so that she gets hanged, but also, you can kind of see his point in terms of being upset with Victor Frankenstein. You know, the one doesn't necessarily negate the other. Having the Minotaur be, like, an innocent all along is unsatisfying, because it presents a plot that is solved because the PCs are the only people around who aren't monsters or idiots. If the Minotaur is not really dangerous, you get this kind of Star Trek situation where everybody except the main characters are just boneheads and the main characters solve it for them. But it's kind of unsatisfying because the problem doesn't feel like it has any real bite. So it could be more interesting to have the Minotaur be dangerous, but there maybe be some way to eliminate that danger. You know, even if it's just like taking him to a desert island where there's no people for him to eat, but he can just, you know, roam to his heart's content. Though he does have to eat people. Or finding some way to break the curse that cursed him with his hunger for blood. And if we're talking about, like, Minotaurs in a fantasy kingdom, rather than specifically in Greek mythology, then of course you can just have a Minotaur be, like, a chill guy, right? You then get the problem of, why is this a Minotaur, not a human? But at least in a Minotaur, you have this cool visual element, which you don't have with, like, a hobgoblin or whatever, right? If you're like, oh, I'm a hobgoblin. Hobgoblins are, you know, militaristic servants of an evil tyrant, but, like, I'm not. I'm just a regular bro. Like, well, then why just be a person, right? People can be in the army. Lots of people are. There's nothing, like, particularly fun about being a hobgoblin, other than the name, which is fun to say. But if you're a Minotaur, then, you know, maybe all you want is to just be, like, a big, strong bull man and look cool with your horns and your hooves and whatnot. And, you know, that's fine. You can do that. I know I come off as critical of the humanization of monsters sometimes. I don't really mean to be. The reason that I have problems with it is I don't know what's different about them enough that they have to be a different thing. And I think that humanization is a response to that process of familiarization. So the image of the Minotaur becomes so commonplace that we regard the monster itself as commonplace. We say that there are Minotaurs, not just a Minotaur, you know, Pegasuses, and not just one Pegasus, and so on and so forth. And then because we feel that the monster is familiar, we feel that it is like our friend, and we interpret those characters as familiar as well. And there have been lots of authors who have taken this position, and in fairness, those authors have not made the Minotaur nothing more than a lovable human stand-in. I read a novel which I swear was a retelling of the myth of Theseus of the Minotaur, but like from Ariadne's perspective, and she views the Minotaur as like, you know, her baby brother who has to be protected. And of course, Borges does it. It has a story told from the perspective of the Minotaur. So the final way to, you know, solve the problem that the Minotaur isn't an unnatural, horrifying creature anymore is to say no, but it's a cool image, and it's something that people are familiar with and that means something to them. So that being the case, let's think about the other ways that we can use it and fill the unnatural, blood-gorged brute slot with something from whatever comes after the Cthulhu mythos. Because the Cthulhu mythos is making that transition right now. So that is what I think about Minotaurs. I don't know beyond The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe why, like, we decided that Minotaurs were a thing, But I think it's not a bad thing necessarily. Even if it just means that my players get to fight a bunch of like Mind Horde guys, I think they're okay with that. Chris, I hope that you've enjoyed this episode and that it's been an interesting look at some of the different angles that contribute to the creation of this monster. Everybody else, if you'd like to be like Chris and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we are going to be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.